Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at kaxc.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Iran has named a new supreme leader. Mujtaba Khamenei is the son of the former supreme leader, who was killed by U.S. and Israeli strikes in Tehran at the start of the war. The new supreme leader has close ties to Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which signals a continuation of his father's rule. Iran launched new strikes today in the region, including on Bahrain's main oil refinery. NPR's Carrie Khan reports leading up to the attack, Israel hit oil storage facilities in Tehran.
A senior Israeli defense official tells NPR that three more weeks are needed to accomplish its goal of decimating Iran's military forces. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to disclose sensitive issues. The strikes on Tehran oil depots are some of the first infrastructure targets in the war. The thick smoke mixed with rain to coat parts of the capital in muddy black water. Iran's military warned in a post on social media, critical infrastructure strikes would be met with equal measures. And that, quote, if you can tolerate oil at more than $200 a barrel, continue this game. Iran hit back striking a desalination plant in Bahrain and a residential site in Saudi Arabia, reporting its first deaths since the start of the war. Gary Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The war in Iran is disrupting oil production and shipping in the Middle East. Crude oil prices spiked above $115 a barrel. NPR's Maria Aspen reports Wall Street is on edge.
U.S. investors and consumers are worried about the surging price of oil after the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran. Companies that rely on oil, including airlines and cruise ships, have seen their shares tumble amid the wider stock market volatility. Meanwhile, inflation-weary consumers are seeing the price of gasoline spike. And if disruptions to the oil supply go much longer, the higher cost of shipping and trucking will likely raise prices for goods of all kinds. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
Another U.S. service member has been killed in the war with Iran. This is the seventh reported American death. NPR's Luke Garrett has more now.
The U.S. service member died after suffering serious injuries from an Iranian attack on March 1st, according to U.S. Central Command. The deadly strike had targeted U.S. troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. The identity of the seventh fallen service member has not been publicly released as the military contacts relatives. On Saturday, President Trump attended the dignified transfer of the remains of the first Americans killed in the war, six Army reservists killed by an Iranian drone strike in Kuwait. Trump and other administration officials have repeatedly said they expect more casualties as the U.S.-Israeli conflict with Iran goes on. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon says the service member died on Saturday. This is NPR News from Washington. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detained three mariachi student musicians and their parents in San Antonio. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton says lawmakers are demanding answers.
15th Congressional District Republican incumbent Monica De La Cruz and her challenger, Democratic nominee Bobby Pulido, along with Democratic U.S. Representative Vicente Gonzalez, all took to social media voicing concerns about the detention of the family. Brothers 18-year-old Antonio Gomez Cuellar, 14-year-old Caleb, and 12-year-old Joshua are being held in two separate detention facilities along with their parents after being taken into custody last month. Antonio and Caleb are both members of the award-winning Mariachi Oro group from McAllen High School. The family came to the U.S. from Mexico in 2023 seeking asylum. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
A plaque honoring officers who protected the U.S. Capitol on January 6 was installed over the weekend after a three-year delay. The bronze plaque is the first official marker of that day when thousands of President Trump's supporters violently stormed the Capitol to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power. More than 140 law enforcement officers were hurt, and there are seven deaths directly linked to the attack.
Federal law required the plaque to be installed 3 years ago. U.S. futures contracts are sinking as concerns over the war in Iran grow. Oil prices have surged up to 30% in the last week. On Wall Street, the three major indices are all down in pre-market trading. Asian stocks finished the day lower, with Tokyo's Nikkei losing more than 5%.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It is 8:05. You're listening to People Powered KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. A mix of clouds and sun expected today. Highs 33 to 41. Northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting higher. Tonight looks like a chance of snow after midnight with lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, a slight chance of snow or rain, mostly cloudy skies. Highs 34 to 39 degrees with a chance of snow overnight with lows around 20. And Wednesday, we'll be looking at partly to mostly sunny skies with highs 35 to 40.
Support comes from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us.
We also receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its finest since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC.
The Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center has auditions for their upcoming production of The Grapes of Wrath. Those are tomorrow, starting at 6 o'clock in the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. No prior theater experience is required.
We are talking about movie-going experiences with the Oscars happening this weekend. You can tune in this Saturday at 9 a.m. for the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. We're also asking about your experiences. What was the first movie you saw in the theater? Where did you see movies when you were younger? And what were your favorite movie theater snacks? Tell us the stories that you have by texting at 218-326-1234.
We heard from Julia, who said, "My family was big on dollar theaters and drive-ins. The drive-in closest to us, the Maple Leaf, was the best of both worlds because they would book movies off first run to keep costs down and would reliably line up a kid-friendly movie before a film more appropriate to parents. I remember being so excited to see Disney's Robin Hood and thinking my mom was unduly excited about it. But as an adult, I now realize the sting followed it as the main feature, and mom definitely had a thing for Robert Redford. One of my favorite memories is falling asleep in the back seat after an entire evening of running feral with other kids in an impromptu pack before the show, then watching the movie while snacking on the smuggled-in snacks and grocery bag of popcorn that fed everyone in the car. As an aside, Milk Duds and hot buttered popcorn is the best movie snack combo, in my opinion."
We also heard from our own Brenda Greeley. An early movie for her was Old Yeller, which she viewed from the projection booth with her dad at the State Theater in Walker. It was so sad. "I cried and cried when Yeller had to be put down after saving the family from the rabid wolf," she says. "And as an early teen, the original Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet was unforgettable. Let's say I learned a lot, and my friend and I left a little embarrassed. At that time, no ratings, but my mom found it necessary to provide her permission for me and my friend." Then she says later on in high school, she went to Play Misty for Me with a date, as well as The Exorcist, watching most of it through the sleeves of my jean jacket, she says, which I can identify with not watching movies because I've seen them through my ball cap at the time. Brenda says Goobers and Coca-Cola were her go-to snacks always.
All right. Let us know your thoughts on your movie-going experiences. Text 218-326-1234. Now we continue with Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's a big question hanging over the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran. How long will this war last?
That question is becoming urgent as the war begins to affect the global economy. Israel escalated the war over the weekend, bombing oil facilities. The disruption of shipments from multiple nations has sent the price of oil soaring. And Iran shows no sign of giving in after choosing a new supreme leader over the weekend.
A senior Israeli military official spoke with NPR's Daniel Estrin about how Israel views the prospects for ending the war. Hey there, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so what is the Israeli timeline? And we may have lost Daniel Estrin there. Daniel, let's try one more time.
Well, just as we're speaking here, you might hear the alarms. We are getting advance notice of... If you're hearing me now, Steve,
we've just got advance notice
on our phones that an Iranian missile is on its way to Israel. So we have a few minutes now to speak before the air raid sirens will go off.
Got it.
But I'll tell you that Israel is expecting that it needs about 3 weeks to achieve its goals in Iran. That's what a senior Israeli defense official told me this weekend. This person is in the military's operations directorate. He spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss Israel's military plans, but he says the goal is to decimate Iran's army, navy, military industries. And Israel also realizes that President Trump could just end the war at any point. So the U.S. is not giving a timeline on how it sees the war and how long it would take. But we do know that the U.S. has not been happy with Israel's targeting of the Iranian oil depots this weekend.
And Daniel, of course, you're going to move when you need to be safe. Don't worry about us at all, but glad you're with us for another moment. It sounds like there's a little bit of daylight between the U.S. and Israel here.
Sure.
But why did Israel target Iran's oil facilities? Pretty dramatic.
Yeah, well, Israel said that Iran was using that oil to fuel Iranian missiles launched at Israel. But this is also civilian infrastructure we're talking about. U.S. officials have been displeased with the extent of the damage that Israel caused. You know, those skies that were blackened and the oily raindrops that dropped onto Tehran. So I heard from a person briefed on the matter, not authorized to speak publicly, that the U.S. was not pleased with the extent of that damage. Even Senator Lindsey Graham, who's close to Prime Minister Netanyahu, tweeted publicly, "Israel, be cautious about your targets because Iran's oil economy will be needed when Iran's regime collapses."
Or Graham hopes it will collapse, although the Iranians seem to be showing what they would consider to be resolve by choosing a supreme leader with the same name as the old supreme leader.
That's right. Iran has appointed Mujtaba Khamenei to be the new supreme leader. He's the son of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed by Israel on day one of the war. And the son is seen as even more hardline than the father was. But Iran has sent a message as well this weekend that it can exact a painful price around the region, not just Israel. We saw Iran launch a missile with a dangerous cluster bomb warhead that hit an apartment building here in Tel Aviv, just a few minutes' drive from me in Tel Aviv, and attacks on oil facilities in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia took place this weekend as well. So we're seeing the Gulf get dragged into this conflict as well. They've been very hesitant to take part in the war, so we're going to have to see where that goes.
Okay. NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv, and Daniel, be sure you're ready to move if you need to in the next few minutes. Appreciate your insights.
You're welcome.
Our next report on the war takes us to the western border of Iran, and it helps to get the geography down.
Okay, so try to picture this. Ethnic Kurds live on both sides of the border. On one side, the Kurds are part of Iran. On the other side, Kurds control their own region of Iraq. Some Iranian armed opposition groups have been based on the Iraqi side for decades. The U.S. has talked of encouraging those Kurds to attack Iran. In recent days, President Trump has suggested that he was for it, but then said he is against it.
NPR's Jane Arraf is on the Iraqi side of the border in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. And she spoke with the deputy prime minister there, Kubad Talabani, on Sunday. She's in the city of Sulaymaniyah. Hi there, Jane.
Hi.
Okay, so what does the Iraqi Kurdish leader say about these Iranian Kurdish groups who seem to live on his territory?
Well, as you know, the Kurds have long been strong U.S. allies, including the fight against ISIS. Now, this was Talabani's first interview with Western media since the start of the war, and he wanted to make clear that neither Iraqi nor Iranian Kurds here would be part of the fight. Let's listen.
We have explained maybe some of the flaws behind the thought of using Iranian Kurds as the tip of the spear to launch any potential uprisings within Iran.
And there he's talking about, explained to U.S. officials. He pointed out that the Kurds are just 9% of the Iranian population, and about half of them are Shia Kurds, many of whom, he says, support the regime. Now, Talabani is deputy prime minister for the entire Kurdistan region. But he says his brother, Vafal Talabani, who's head of the party that controls this part of Iraqi Kurdistan, spoke with Trump last week and relayed this message.
Our forces would not get involved under any circumstances. This is not our war, and we've made that very clear.
Talabani points out that in a country the size of Western Europe with 90 million people, Iran, and multiple ethnic groups, chaos would be disastrous.
Appreciate that statement that Iraq is the size of Western Europe. You realize what it would take to invade and take over such a place. I want to explain further where you are. The Kurdistan region of Iraq broke away from the Iraqi government many years ago, but it's still technically part of Iraq, still part of Iraq. How vulnerable is it to getting involved in the war, whether it wants to or not?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about the geography. It is squeezed in the middle. On one side, there's Iran, and on the other side, it's a pro-Iranian Iraq government. The U.S. military bases in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region, have been the most heavily hit by Iran and Iran-backed Iraqi missiles. Militias. But Sulaymaniyah province, where we are, has also been affected. Here's Talabani on the drone strikes from Iraq.
It's also escalating tensions between the Kurdistan region and the rest of Iraq. These are groups that are paid by the state firing at us. What's going on here?
He says they've asked the U.S. to press the Iraqi government to help stop those attacks. And he points out that Kurds here have no air defenses to stop the strikes.
Has Iran been in contact with the Kurds during this war?
Yes, he says the last time was a few days ago when a high-level delegation, alarmed by news reports that the U.S. was pressing for armed opposition groups here to cross that border, came from Tehran.
They were trying to understand the realities of this reporting about whether or not we're about to invade Iran. And we made it very clear, no, we have no interest and there's no means to, and that is not our policy.
And Steve Talabani said he wanted to make clear that Kurds were not guns for hire.
Okay. NPR's Jane Araf reporting from the Kurdish city of Sulaymaniyah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The war has created an enormous bottleneck in the Strait of Hormuz.
Hundreds of oil tankers are stuck on both sides of this critical Mideast waterway out of fear of attack by Iran. There are now escalating concerns of a global energy crisis, but it's not just oil tankers. Cargo ships are also stranded, creating a shortage of essential goods getting to the Persian Gulf region.
NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam joins us next. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, wow. One-fifth of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas passes through this one strait, the Strait of Hormuz. Is it just as important for the container ships?
Right. Well, container ships represent a much smaller global percentage, about 3%, than the oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. But they're carrying valuable cargo, aluminum, fertilizer, and food to the Middle East. And I spoke with Matthew Wright, and he's the lead freight analyst at Kepler, which is a global trade intelligence provider. And he says the Mideast relies on the container ships.
90% of its food is imports, particularly on the fresh side. And the fact that those cargoes are not able to go in, this could be a fairly critical issue for the region.
You know, Wright says at the moment container ships are not passing through the Strait of Hormuz because of the security risk. And last week a container ship did come under attack. The crew abandoned ship. It's been adrift. And when a tugboat from the United Arab Emirates went out to assist it, it was struck by a missile, killing all eight on board.
Amazing then. So what happens to the cargo of all these ships when they can't move?
Well, it sits. It sits in port. You know, there are roughly 120 cargo ships in limbo at ports in the Gulf region. And not surprisingly, shipping companies are not accepting new bookings because, you know, we've got all this fresh food and the other things sitting there. And they have no idea, the companies, how long the conflict's going to last. And as I spoke with, say, the shipping industry is, you know, designed to keep things moving. And the situation in the Strait of Hormuz is scrambling. That cargo's piling up, stress on the ports, things are slowing down, and all this is not good from a market standpoint.
Okay, as I understand it, President Trump has talked of the U.S. Navy escorting tankers and ships through the Strait of Hormuz, which would be a kind of replay of the 1980s when something like this happened. The U.S. put flags on oil, U.S. flags on oil tankers and so forth to get them through safely. But when he raises that idea in the 21st century, what kind of reception does it get?
Lukewarm, I would say. You know, the U.S. Navy also tried this in the Red Sea, using escorts to protect ships from attacks by Yemen's Houthis. And analysts say, you know, it didn't have much impact. And let's face it, Iran is more sophisticated than the Houthis from a military point of view and its ability to target moving vessels. And traveling alongside a U.S. naval vessel might make a tanker or a container ship more of a tempting target for Iran. But, you know, Steve, Iran knows that launching the odd missile or drone or at a vessel or even the threat of one can strangle marine traffic in the Strait of Hormuz like we're seeing now. And it's using that as a weapon. And, you know, this bottleneck is creating serious threat for the global energy, shipping, and frankly, the global economy.
NPR's Jackie Northam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Live radio on NPR News.
It is 8:21. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Today, a mix of clouds and sun with highs 33 to 41 with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour gusting higher. Tonight, a chance of snow after midnight with lows in the 20s. Slight chance of rain and snow tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 34 to 39, chance of snow overnight with lows around 20, and Wednesday, partly to mostly sunny skies, highs 35 to 40.
Support comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org.
We also receive support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com.
Coming up at 8:30, it's a special edition of the Up North Report. Megan Buffington introduces us to our latest North Star student. Her name is Ronnie Noska from Staples Motley. And coming up at 8:45, we'll have a story from Aaron Summers, who was part of the recent Storytelling for Spirit and Courage event. And then 9 o'clock, I get to be your host for Headwaters. Great mix of music. Looking forward to that. And Monday means request line. And today is National Get Over It Day. So the request line is songs about getting over it. Moving on. Okay. Text in your suggestions, 218-326-1234.
KEXE kicks off our 50th birthday celebration with People Powered Pilsner, a collaboration with Clock Owl Brewing in Grand Rapids, Bemidji Brewing, and Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. There's a beer release party this Friday from 4 to 7 at Bemidji Brewing. KEXE DJs will be spinning records, and a portion of all Pilsner sales goes to KEXE. Join us as we say cheers to 50 years and many more.
We continue now with news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition, including a remembrance of country Joe McDonald, who passed away over the weekend.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Latinos have a long history in the United States, but some say that despite their many contributions to this nation, they're being demonized by political rhetoric. As the country celebrates its 250th anniversary this year, many Latinos who are U.S. citizens are questioning whether they belong. NPR's Marisa Peñalosa reports.
Adios. At a recent potluck in Austin, Texas, chicken and creamy potato soup simmer on the stove. It's the monthly meeting of Las Comadres para las Americas, or Godmothers for the Americas, where Latina women gather to connect. About two dozen show up carrying salads, cheese, and fruit platters.
Hello, hello. Hola, comadre.
The group was created 25 years ago. It's now a national nonprofit. Lourdes Rodriguez is hosting on this night.
go fix yourself a plate and let's sit down so we can get started.
The women typically stay away from politics, but they break that rule to talk about what they see as the Trump administration's assaults on Latinos amid an aggressive immigration crackdown.
It hurts me. It hurts me seeing all this injustice. Sometimes I cannot take it. I'm angry.
This is not the country that I expected the United States to be today. I expected to have equality. I expected to be treated as a human being.
It's enough. Ya basta. We have been too quiet for too long. This is a moment for us to come together rather than saying, I'm a citizen, so it doesn't directly affect. It affects all of us.
That's Gina Vasquez, Nora de Hoyos Comstock, Las Comadres founder, and Josefina Casati. Millions of Hispanics voted for President Trump in 2024, but now most disapprove of his immigration and economic policies, according to national polling. Evelyn Escamilla, a graphic designer and mother of three, says she's conflicted. She feels patriotic and yet not in a celebratory mood to mark the country's 250th birthday.
Just the word celebration alone is triggering. I'm Mexican-American. I was born in this country. I was raised in this country. Yet, because of my heritage, I'm afraid. I'm afraid to be out in the street. I don't think we have much to celebrate.
I asked the woman if any of them or their families voted for President Trump. Nearly half of the group's hands go up. Many say they are angry, but they also feel hopeless and afraid. Carolina Perez is a U.S. citizen and the daughter of Cuban exiles.
People are not understanding that there are no real rules right now.
Daniel Garza is the founder and president of the Libre Initiative, a conservative Latino nonprofit. Garza says not everyone is worried about the Trump administration's immigration crackdown.
If you're undocumented, yes, you should feel threatened. But if you're an American naturalized or born citizen, Latino, you don't have the same priority as that community does. Your priorities right now are the economy, jobs, opportunity.
The economy is one area where Latino contributions stand out. According to a recent UCLA report, Latinos provide about 70% of the growth in the national GDP and the labor force. Another area where Latinos stand out is the armed forces, where they are overrepresented in the largest branches. At Joe's Bakery in Austin, I meet a group of U.S. military veterans. One is Chris Sanchez, who enlisted in 1968.
Latinos in the military, for us, we're not liberal, we're not conservative, you know, we're Americans. Latinos have always been very patriotic. They've been involved in every war.
Sanchez is a third-generation American, and many members of his family have served the country, he says. Colonel Frank Maldonado is 81. His parents came from Mexico. He says he enlisted in the Army right out of high school. He became a helicopter pilot and served in Vietnam.
My mom did not want me in the military. My dad was proud that he had given one of his sons to his adopted country. He was so proud.
Maldonado's eyes well up. He disagrees with the way Trump is running the country, but he remains hopeful.
One day, we'll get back to what America should be. I'm not giving up on him. It's never going to be perfect, but every little bit we can do to make it better, we got to continue.
Maldonado says he wouldn't miss celebrating his country's 250th birthday. He plans to get together with his kids and grandkids on the 4th of July to set off some fireworks. Marisa Peñalosa, NPR News, Austin.
One of the performers at the famous Woodstock Festival has died. Joe McDonald led the band Country Joe and the Fish. He used to get crowds to spell their name, F-I-S-H. When they were invited to play at Woodstock in 1969, they led hundreds of thousands of people to spell a different F word and then played this.
Well, come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
That is the I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die rag. Joe McDonald was born on New Year's Day, 1942, at a time when his parents were so interested in the Communist Party that they named him after Joseph Stalin. McDonald was a Navy veteran, although his service ended before the Vietnam War. He started the band in 1965. By Woodstock in 69, infighting among the bandmates was taking its toll. A year later, they split up.
Country Joe McDonald continued as a solo act, releasing albums and touring well into the 2000s, although he remained most famous for that cutting, cynical rebuke of the Vietnam draft. He did say he was suspicious of how different audiences interpreted his song. Here he is at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1996.
When I sing Fixing to Die Rag for Vietnam veterans, I know what they're feeling and what they're thinking. But when I sing it to a regular audience, I don't know what the hell they're thinking.
And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, I ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Joe McDonald died Saturday of complications from Parkinson's disease. He was 84.
Louder!
This is NPR News.
It is 8:30. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Good morning. With the Oscars happening this weekend, we've been talking about movies. You can tune in Saturday at 9 a.m. for the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. And also our question of the week is we're wanting to know about your movie going experiences. What was the first movie you saw in the theater, and where did you see movies when you were younger? What were your favorite movie theater snacks? You can text us at 218-326-1234. We want to hear your stories.
Coming up in just a moment, we're going to have a special edition of the Up North Report, and 9 o'clock it is Headwaters. I'll be your host. I'm Jennifer Barr. We did got a suggestion from Barry, who said Looking Past You by Newgrass Revival for my request line theme, which is songs about getting over it. So thank you for that suggestion. Keep them coming. Text 218-326-1234.
Whatever it is, we're getting over it today.
That's right. It is National Get Over It Day. Here's Megan Buffington with the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. North Star Student is a new series from KAXE where we recognize Northern Minnesota students for their athletic accomplishments, artistic endeavors, academic achievements, or other efforts. Our second ever North Star student is Staples Motley Jr. Ronnie Noska. She is ranked as one of the top tennis players in the state. She's a four-time state qualifier, including a fourth-place finish in doubles and two consolation runners-up in singles. Noska was nominated by her coach, Nikki Paskowitz, because of her amazing career and the fact that she's got one more season full of fun and achievement ahead of her. I spoke with Noska and Paskowitz, starting with how Noska got her start on the court.
I think I started playing tennis practically when I started to be able to walk. My mom has six other siblings, and all other five of those siblings play tennis. My grandpa was a big role in it. He actually just passed away this last winter, so it was a little weird not having him there. But I started playing junior high in like fourth grade, fifth grade, like whenever I could. I had a lot of friends on the varsity team.
What makes you passionate about tennis?
I've always been like a very hard worker, and tennis isn't something that will come easy for really anybody, even if you're super talented. So just the competition with yourself, not even like competing with other people, but like the mental clarity you get from exercising and just like the competition you have with yourself. And like, it's something that you can always work at 100% at.
How have you seen Ronnie grow in all the years, whether from little, from tennis camps, or maybe when you started coaching? How has she grown and changed over that time?
I think she's grown in just like taking pressure off of herself. I think that's something she puts a lot of pressure on herself in like areas of life to like be her best. And I think her just being able to like take a step back and like find joy in the things that she's pushing herself in and like doing it for herself has been really fun to watch.
Beyond tennis, what else are you involved in? What else should people know about you?
I hunt all the time. I duck hunt, goose hunt, grouse, pheasant, all fall long, which is hard because of tennis. I can't get out there all the time, but I think I missed 3 mornings all duck season up until deer hunting. And obviously, like, sections and state, I had a miss. I deer hunt, turkey hunt. That's basically the biggest thing that I do is I hang out with my friends and cousins, and we all go hunting together. And
well, are there any hunting memories or accomplishments you want to brag about, too?
Not really. I mean, I think this year my family has access to a private lake, and we limit it out almost every day for a couple weeks there. I did end up halfway through having about 8 hours of homework to do. So we slept in the canoe overnight, and at 3 in the morning, I was on my Chromebook or my MacBook doing my homework out in the lake. My cousins are like, are you like, seriously, you're doing your homework now? I'm like, I need to turn it in.
Ronnie's also really smart. We've got a really smart team. But I think that should be highlighted.
The last kind of tie a bow on it question I wanted to ask you, Nikki, is just why nominate Ronnie? Why does she deserve to be recognized?
I think it's just like fun to see, like you said, just someone who's like not like your normal like tennis player, like have so much success in it. And just like the way we ended our year as a team and like her as an individual, I'm really excited like for what's coming for her and for our team too. And so I just like thought she was a really good fit for it. She just works really hard and has for a really long time. And I think just getting excited for what's to come too. So yeah, highlighting what's happened and then also like getting excited for what's coming too.
That was Staples Motley tennis coach Nikki Paskowitz and junior Ronnie Noska, KAXE's North Star student. If you know of a North Star student in your area, you can nominate them at KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
We'll have Megan's extended conversation with Ronnie Noska, North Star student, this Thursday on the morning show. Also, you can go to KAXE.org right now and see more on that story and some excellent photos as well. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on KAXE.
Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. You can ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Have any questions? You can call Sarah at 218-326-1234.
And programming is supported by The Forge in Grand Rapids, offering a space where students, entrepreneurs, and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses, building a culture of innovation and diversity in the heart of Itasca County. Learn more at theforgeitasca.org, where ideas take shape. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to hear from Aaron Summers, who told a story recently at Storytelling for Spirit and Courage. And at 9 o'clock, I'll be your host for Headwaters. Right now, though, we are going to listen to some new music from Esther Rose. This one's called That's My DJ. It's a new single from Esther Rose called That's My DJ here on the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
The University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership, the Initiative Foundation, and Happy Dancing Turtle are co-hosting the Community Client Leaders Program with 4 in-person sessions in Pine River and an online curriculum. Find more information at z.umn.edu/climateleader. Registration is due by the 16th.
Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids has a special rate for new curlers during the month of March. There is space for new teams on Tuesdays at 5:30 or Thursdays at 7:30. Find more info at itascacurling.com.
The Open Closet at Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids is in need of clothing donations, especially in men's sizes. Gently used clothing is accepted, as well as new socks and underwear.
Our temperatures right now are kind of where they're going to hang out for the day. We've got 36 in Grand Rapids, 40 in Brainerd, 32 in Bemidji, 39 in Aiken, 33 in Park Rapids. Depending on where you are, you may be seeing sun or clouds with highs, like I said, right where they are, about 33 to 41. Winds from the northwest, 10 to 15, gusting higher. We do have a chance of snow after midnight with lows in the 20s, and tomorrow, slight chance of rain or snow with mostly cloudy skies and highs in the mid to upper 30s.
So enjoy the warmer temperatures while they last.
Yeah, it is a bit breezy out there, although it looks like it's maybe died down a bit from where we were earlier, but that's, it's going to kind of be kind of a gusty day, I think. So on and off. Storyteller Aaron Summers wore his red glitter Converse high tops to Clacko Brewing in Grand Rapids recently. He had come to share this story at Storytelling for Spirit and Courage.
I was born here in Grand Rapids. This Grand Rapids, not the Michigan one. The one that also produced Judy Garland. In my own hometown, that's not trivia. That is scripture. Judy is less a celebrity and more a municipal deity. We have lakes, we have trees, and we have Judy. Every year there was a Judy Garland festival that swallowed downtown whole. A parade, a marching band, free screenings of The Wizard of Oz at the local theater. As a child, I did not know I was in a small Midwest town. I thought I was in a very specific musical theater cult, and I was thriving. My mom took my brothers and I every year. I met Mickey Rooney. I met multiple actors that played Munchkins. One year, I even wore a t-shirt that said, I heart Munchkins. That shirt aged like an unrefrigerated potato salad. But I have evolved. At first, Judy was just a star to me. A big voice, big eyes, big feelings. Then I learned she was a gay icon. And later, when I came out, something inside me snapped into focus like a stage light warming up. When I came out, my mom struggled. She wanted reasons, explanations, a PowerPoint maybe. And because I had never once let a joke pass me by, I said, well, perhaps raising me in a town that worships Judy Garland and fully immersing me in Judy Garland culture played a role. To be clear, no one is turned gay by Judy Garland. If that were true, the Midwest would look like Pride with better casseroles. But in a world where people weaponize the word grooming against anything sparkly and alive, I understand how ridiculous that joke can sound. Judy did not make me queer, but she did give my queerness a soundtrack. Because there is a deeper truth. Like Judy, I love to perform. I crave the stage. I crave the applause. Not because I'm shallow. I mean, I am a little shallow. I do own glitter eyeliner. But deeper than that, applause feels like oxygen. It feels like proof of existence. Growing up, I learned that love could be conditional, that validation had to be earned. So where do you go when you want a guaranteed affirmation? You go where the lights are hot and the audience claps because you moved them. Judy wanted everything: fame, adoration, security, love. I want everything too. And beneath that hunger is something softer. We both wanted stability, to be enough without performing for it. Judy did not find that stability. What she found was immortality, an icon, a legend, a voice that still echoes long after the curtain fell. Sometimes I wonder if I am destined for a tragic art like hers. And if so, I have logistical questions. If I am suffering from my art, where is my biopic? Who is playing me? I do have casting opinions. But here's where I draw the line in Rhinestone. Judy became the first-rate version of herself in a world that demanded she be manageable, marketable, and smaller. She paid for that with pieces of her life. I cannot afford that price, emotionally, spiritually, or in this economy. What I can afford is honesty. I can afford therapy. I can afford to build an artistry that does not devour me. Being born in the same town as Judy Garland is a fun fact, a cocktail party opener, a Midwestern party trick. But inheriting her defiance, her hunger, her refusal to dim, that feels sacred. My queerness is not a punchline. It is not a scandal. It is not a phase brought on by my excessive exposure to show tunes in northern Minnesota. It is a prism, and Judy was one of the lights that hit it. So I lace up my sparkly red Converse. Not ruby slippers. I prefer arch support. I step out onto the yellow brick road, which looks suspiciously like a stage with a mic stand, and I go. Not trying to be the next Judy, not trying to be tragic enough to earn icon status, just trying to be a first-rate version of myself. Loud, vulnerable, glittering at the edges. Still chasing applause, yes, but also chasing wholeness. Judy Garland will always live in my hometown. She will always live in queer history, and she will always live in a part of me. And that knows pain can sing, still demand, and have a standing ovation. Thank you.
That is Erin Summers at a live storytelling concert in Grand Rapids, supported in part by an artist equity grant from the Arrowhead Regional Arts Council, thanks to the McKnight Foundation. It is about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
We receive support from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash Pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details are available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com.
We also thank Happy Dancing Turtle, a nonprofit organization dedicated to growing stewards through education programs and experiences. More information at happydancingturtle.org.
A mix of clouds and sun today, highs 33 to 41 with northwest winds, 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting higher possibly. Tonight, we're looking at a chance of snow after midnight with lows 21 to 28. Tuesday, tomorrow, slight chance of rain or snow, mostly cloudy. Highs 34 to 39 with a chance of snow overnight with lows around 20. And Wednesday, we'll be looking at partly to mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 30s.
This is new music from Jose Gonzalez. It's called A Perfect Storm.
From the sidelines, pushing for a race against time, tempting us to deplete only a face of certain defeat. Hey now, it's over. We'll be right back.
as the dominoes start to fall.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. A federal judge has ruled that a Trump administration official illegally tried to dismantle the Voice of America. That's the government-funded broadcaster that provides news to people living under repressive regimes. The judge ruled that Carrie Lake, a Republican politician, did not have authority to oversee the network and its federal parent agency, and the judge has declared her actions void. NPR's David Folkenflik was the first to question Lake's legal authority to run VOA, and he's now with us. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What did Carrie Lake change or try to change at VOA?
Well, let's start with what VOA is. Voice of America was started in World War II and has continued in the decades since to provide sort of factual news, not propaganda, to countries that don't have a free press or don't have really a functioning free press. Carrie Lake and President Trump have attacked it as basically being propaganda and hostile to President Trump himself. She sought to effectively dismantle it. So she laid off hundreds and hundreds of employees at Voice of America and a couple of its sister networks. She tried to cut off funding from other networks like Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, that are funded by the federal government to reach other foreign lands. She canceled a contract for a new headquarters that her predecessors said would save tens of millions of dollars for the federal government. And she basically tried to cut these things down to the bone and to essentially make it impossible for them to continue to function.
Yeah, in some cases, programming was stopped or disrupted. So why did the judge nullify all of that?
Well, previously, there are these lawsuits challenging basically all of these things. And previously, the judge in this case is senior U.S. District Court judge named Roy C. Lamberth. He took issue with some of her decisions. Not only was she, you know, cutting back deeply, these things were effectively blocked from broadcasting at all. And he said, you know, that wasn't legal. The appeals court took issue with some of what he did. But nonetheless, this time he sidestepped that question. He said, look, this isn't a question of whether the actions she took were legal. It's a question of saying she didn't have the authority to make those decisions. She was assigned in late February of last year to be a senior advisor to the agency by President Trump. But within days, she was designated as having basically all of the powers of the CEO, which is a position that's supposed to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Later in July, she was made deputy CEO. And a few weeks after that, she announced that she was the acting CEO. Again in July, she was delegated all of the powers of the CEO. But I couldn't find that the White House had actually named her to that. I asked her about a dozen times, and I asked the agency that she runs, called the U.S. Agency for Global Media over the Voice America, and I asked the White House, who named her? Did the president make this announcement? Is there any documentation, all of which has to exist just to become the acting CEO? I never found or was given any documentation for that. The judge ruled precisely this. In neither case, neither as senior advisor or as acting CEO or whatever, did she have the authority to take on those powers. He said she didn't seem to have the ability to be acting CEO either.
So she's not an official. She's like a rogue politician, according to the judge. How has Lake responded, though?
Well, she says she's going to appeal. She's called Lamberth an activist judge. She said to me she was acting legally, but again, there was none of this documentation for that.
Is there any way to reverse all the layoffs and other cancellations and changes?
Well, if the judge's ruling stands, there's hope among Voice America journalists that they can do so. But it's hard to unwind changes or put the toothpaste back in the tube, as one VOA official said on Twitter in recent hours. Many people have taken different jobs. Some of these networks have effectively been shut down. And, you know, if you cut off these relationships with these hundreds of millions of listeners a week, it's hard to rebuild. And yet people are hoping to do just that.
And NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is still broadcasting. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy. Thanks so much for tuning in to KAXE this morning.
Good morning. It is a mix of cloud and sun expected today with highs 33 to 41 with northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting higher tonight with a chance of snow after midnight, lows 21 to 28. Tuesday, a slight chance of rain or snow, mostly cloudy, highs 34 to 39. Chance of snow overnight with lows around 20. And Wednesday, partly to mostly sunny with highs 35 to 40.
Yeah, we had a very gloomy start after the sun rose this morning, but now I'm seeing some peaks of blue sky here in Grand Rapids, so there's some hope for the day. I think, yeah, temperatures kind of sticking right where they are. We've got a range of 32 right now in Bemidji up to 40 in Brainerd for our current temperatures. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE.